It is Saturday, November 13th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, and the second half, we're talking about hybrid hard drives. That's right. How do those little suckers work?
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In the second half of today's show, we'll be speaking about hybrid hard drives with Seagate design engineer John Moon. But first, we'll be doing geek news. I want to let you know that Geek Speak is a Creative Commons endeavor. You can share this as long as you credit us. And if you make new content, share that as well in the same way. You can learn more about the Creative Commons licensing at creativecommons.org. Today's Geek Speak theme is by Al Luckow. Thank you, Al. And if you think you can do better than that theme song or just different, please do. Produce a song and send us a link. We'd love to air it.
I can definitely do something different.
You can do something different, Miles? You'd be singing something a cappella, I know it.
You do something different every time you host the show, right? And the theme doesn't play, you sing.
We're waiting.
I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, political junkie, and sometimes musical aficionado.
Aficionado? I don't. Well, okay. Yeah, whatever.
No. Morning.
Good morning.
And Al Luckow. Alec is a new media architect. Morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe is a freelance media guy. That means you could probably get him to your house if you pay him the right amount of money. Is that right? You're basically a tech
I don't know.
We don't want to use that
I
word.
Don't know what I do anymore. I do
nice
too many things.
On,
thank you. Yeah, yeah.
We are going to start about why my muscles are sore. Al, can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I just recently doing a lot of interface design, I was interested in the Microsoft Xbox Kinect sensor, which allows a person to stand in front of the TV with this device, and it's basically projecting this like pincushion of infrared light, and you're able to interact with the interface just by waving your hand. So you move your hand, and there's a cursor, and then the cursor moves around on the screen itself. We've talked about this. It was Project, what was it, Miles, Natal. That, you know, had been around, and I think I mentioned it once before, but now, you know, I bought one of these things because I just, you know, interested. I don't really have any game consoles.
And this idea of doing certain things with a computer based just on visuals of an individual has been around for a long time. And in the art world, at my professional life, it's always a difficult thing to do. And there's been a lot of pieces I've seen that are really kind of cool. Some of them work better than others. Most of the time, you have to put IR dots on the people. You have to actually add stuff to them. You have the Wii controller, for example, actually has an IR light on it, mm-hmm. so it's actually being picked up by the cameras of the Wii.
Right.
So there's normally something you have to change the person. Mm-hmm. In any kind of motion tracking systems, you see a lot of those little styrofoam white balls that are sticking on people's shoulders, covering them, so the cameras can track them. And those, of course, multiple camera shots. This is completely different. This is just a scanning effect.
Yep. You don't even know you're just standing there.
You're just standing in front of the TV.
And an interesting thing is that my little boy. You know, I put him in front of it, and you know, this is a pristine mind, 5 years old, Alex, and he understood how to operate the interface in less than a minute.
Gosh,
and as an interface designer, to see that, to see somebody walk in front of something, just not know how to do anything, he looks and he sees it and just doesn't. He's moving
great,
things around.
They use the cues of a mirror, right? So they you've got the normal interface where you've got multiple buttons, you can have different choices where you mm-hmm. normally click with a mouse. And instead, you kind of behind that in a ghosty reflection is a avatar of you.
Yep.
You know, and as you move, it moves, and pretty soon you realize, oh well, if I move up my hand up to the space that I want to click, mm-hmm. there's the little thing that says it's clicking. Really, really cool. Anyway, and the thing that was great about it is we played a video game, I don't know, for about a half an hour, and we were jumping and running and leaping and kicking. And
yeah.
I was panting by the end of it.
Oh, man.
Cool.
I played this thing at night, and I'm sweating, and the next day I'm sore.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, this is like, you know, a video game where you're not sitting on the couch just moving your thumbs. I mean, these things, you actually move your body.
I moved my thumbs, too, though. I didn't hold my thumbs still.
Well, you can move your thumbs. Ultimately, you're moving all parts. But, I mean, it really does work you out. And interestingly enough, Apple was originally the guy who came up with this this idea. He originally brought it to Apple and a few years ago. And Apple said, not interested.
So, I love your description of seeing the game consoles that all have this kind of work where you're using more of your body. And everybody else but Microsoft currently have batons or wands, something you've got to hold and attach to you or whatever to make it work. And this thing is working without that. Now, the thing that I was very skeptical that it would actually function as well as it did, but it was very engaging and a lot of fun. I definitely felt like I had control over what was going on.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of that, it's not doing exactly what I want, so I'm going to have to train to be better at it. So,
but it's always a little bit of that, and plus I just kind of threw it up onto my thing. Yeah. I didn't really like try to calibrate it. You know, I didn't.
But
really...
I wanted one, and it's been a long time since I've seen a video game.
Me too. I mean, I've stayed away from video games since the Atari.
For those, it translates to us 6 hours sitting in front of a screen, moving your thumbs.
Right.
That's all you do,
exactly.
Right? And so now, all of a sudden, to have it something more active.
It's totally an interesting thing.
Let's go into it.
I don't know what you're talking about. I flex my back every time I turn around and go, oh, I'm sorry, are you dead again, Lyle?
Miles and I have a long history of fighting each other online.
Oh.
That's why I don't play anymore, actually. Yeah. Just getting pummeled to death in Quake. All right, thank you very much for letting me play that game and getting me addicted to it. I appreciate
it.
Let's get into a bigger subject. Ben, do you have something large to talk about?
Well, I've got something large. It's also small within its sphere, we'll say. So enough puns that no one gets before I introduce the topic. I'm talking about planets. I'm actually talking about dwarf planets. And as many of us know, Pluto is no longer a planet and hasn't been for quite a while. It was back in 2005 or 2006, I think. And they decided to classify it as a dwarf planet, and that was because they were discovering all of these other things way out about as far as Pluto and further than Pluto that were some of them actually roughly the same size as Pluto. And so, you know, they were saying, okay, well, this is one reason why, you know, we can't just say, oh, the solar system is 9 planets. Oh, wait, no, it's 10. Wait, no, we just found 2 more over there, so it's 12. So they drew a line in the sand and Pluto became not a planet. So they were just measuring Eris, which is one of the dwarf planets. Its orbit is about twice as far out as Pluto. And it turns out that for a long time we thought that Eris was larger than Pluto. Now we're actually finding that it's about the same size as Pluto.
Slightly smaller, actually.
The estimate is around 1,170 kilometers, having a radius of that, maybe a little bit less. And Pluto is 1,172 kilometers. So,
but doesn't Pluto have a very close moon that's quite large? Or am I wrong about
Charon,
that?
Charon.
Charon.
Named after the boatman, but it was also named after his wife, who was named Charon. So it's
That's why Pluto looked larger for a while, or because it's you have to calculate its orbit based.
Yeah,
with
a natural satellite that's so large compared to the planet, you know, I mean, our moon is pretty big.
Okay, so this new one, what's it called again?
It's actually not a new one. We've known about it for a long time. We just haven't been able to measure it. So the way we measured it is, it's Eris,
E-R-I-S,
and we measured it by looking at it as it occulted a star, and that means it passed in front of a star. And so this is actually really cool. We were looking at it from different observatories all across the world, and the southernmost edge of the Atacama Desert, it blinked out for 27 seconds, which means it passed in front of the star and it blocked the star for 27 seconds. But only about 500 miles north of that, two other telescopes saw it block out for 78 seconds instead of 27 seconds. So we can kind of figure it's because it's a sphere, and so the bottom part or the middle part or whatever is occulting the star.
I love that we use the planet Earth as the sensor array.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
You
know,
of it like, by looking at all the different
we measure depth and size of things by having two eyes that are only a couple inches apart. What if you had two telescopes on different sides of the entire, like on different parts of the planet, you know, and those are your two eyes.
Now that's parallax, baby.
Really far away. Yeah. But anyway, this is kind of exciting because we know its mass, and its mass, we know its mass, and finding that it's as small as or smaller than Pluto means that it's much denser. And so, you know, everyone's really kind of interested in, you know, is Pluto bigger or is Eris bigger or whatever, all of the mainstream media and people mm-hmm. reading about this. But what's really interesting astronomers and also interests me is what are the histories of these dwarf planets, you know?
Right.
If Eris, if we have the mass known and we know that it's a lot denser, around 2.5 grams per centimeter cubed instead of 2 grams per centimeter cubed like Pluto, that means that they probably formed in different ways, or it's very possible that they did, or have different histories, came from different places. So, you know, it throws a lot of questions up.
Cool. And thank you so much. Yeah. I'm glad to hear we've known the mass for a while, because those should be relatively easy to calculate by the speed and the distance. But, right, we haven't known the volume.
We know the mass because we were looking at Eris's moon. You know, we were talking about how Pluto has a natural satellite. Eris has a natural satellite as well called Dysnomia. And just looking at the orbit of that and the distance it is from Eris, we were able to
Well, thank you, Ben. That's a really lovely story.
Actually, it's one other aspect to that. Astrophysicists are also very excited about this discovery because they had assumed that in the Oort cloud, when you have all of those objects out there, that they were all going to that all the models predicted that they would form in exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm. So they'd be homogeneous in their material.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That they are.
And like, now we're seeing a difference. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, right. And so it's throwing off what all these assumptions we've had for decades.
Right.
Just throwing them in disarray and having to start over.
Yeah, really cool.
It's called the Kuiper Belt, or K-U-I.
Kuiper.
Kuiper, yes. Leave it to Miles to pronounce things correctly. I'll just, you know, blather on.
No, I seriously don't ever pronounce things correctly, but I happen to know that's Kuiper Belt.
But yeah, it is. They are the two largest objects in the Kuiper Belt, which, you know, looking at it, as Miles was saying, you know, assuming that everything kind of forms the same way. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they have different densities that they're so different, you know, it's 2.5 to 2. That's, yeah.
Of course, one of them could be a captured object as well. So
that's true. That's
but
true.
Any case, and that environment is very low on any kind of liquid, right? It's really cold.
I know it's very cold. I assume it's low on liquid.
Well, if it's really cold,
certainly not,
it's not
water,
it's not wet,
or something
that's for
like
sure.
That. Yeah. Maybe another
very
element.
Dry
I'm not sure.
Space.
Right. Yeah.
Miles, can you tell us about something that's not so dry?
Oh my God, that was an elaborate setup.
I know it was.
Yes, in the UK, they're trying to combat STDs. And, you know, why is that geeky? That sounds like squishy science, not sort of the technical
science. Squishy science.
We don't do biology.
Yeah. Well, in this case, we're kind of skirting that line because they're looking at technology where you have a small little chip about the size of a USB device, a USB controller chip. And
no one knows how big that is.
Well, think of how big your thumb drive is. So it has to be smaller than that.
It's about the size of a dime. We're talking about that kind of size.
Right. Something very small.
Or small.
And what you do is you treat it much like you would treat a pregnancy test or whatever. You urinate on it, and then you would plug it into your a specially designed phone, a phone that had a slot for this.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be able to do the chemical analysis or the biological analysis, I should say, and then transmit that analysis over to a lab so they can look at it, and then they give you back your results as to whether or not you have an STD. So no doctor visit, no anything like that. You just kind of, you know, you pee on it, you drop it in your phone, and then
Why do you drop it in your phone?
Well, you need to transmit the raw information somewhere.
The raw information is something you cannot determine. So it needs to be transmitted somewhere to be interpreted and then back to you with the thing saying, yes, you're...
Okay. So
what kind of phones
have extra ports? I'm assuming we're talking about phones because you want it highly portable. You don't want to rely on a laptop or something. So it's going to have some device that allows you to plug into a standard, like all Motorola phones.
They're single-use items.
They are.
Just like a pregnancy test would be a single-use item.
All right.
So you have a phone that can take the input data, but the input data gets... you know, switched out.
That's really cool. So the entire, I mean, I've heard about these chip analysis, biological chip, you know, analysis things. I didn't know that. I thought the chip, the output of it was relatively conclusive, but it sounds like it's more like a very complex pattern that it records, and then that has to be analyzed by something larger.
Right. Well, you're talking about more than one STD.
Right.
So it's not just like a pregnancy test, which is yes or no.
Right.
If it's not a yes or no, you can't just look at a plus or a minus and say, oh, yeah, that's the way it's going to be. You have to...
I love the idea of taking a home pregnancy test and adding a chip and throwing it on your phone so your doctor can call you and tell you instead of just looking at the plus or minus. complicated, geeky stuff. But that's cool. And we've covered stories also that the chips that can actually detect different types of colds you'd have, different viruses mm-hmm. you'd have. So this would, I guess, some of these are viruses, some aren't. So I would assume that it would do a collection of different types of detection. Pretty cool. Thank you very much for that story.
Or it opens up the door for it, yeah.
You know, one thing that I would find very interesting as well, of course, this technology isn't being sold, right, currently. It's, I think it's in development stages, right?
Right. They're working on the app. It has not been released to the public.
And will they, also, do you think they'll eventually make it so that it will be reusable and that you can just, like, put your phone on the ground anytime you want, do your business, and then call your doctor? what's up?
One-stop shopping, use the phone
to
call the doctor.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's urine or saliva.
Or. Okay.
No.
Because it's and. You got to do that in a very specific way.
That's awful. If somebody just turned on the radio, they just heard, I'm sorry, it's urine or saliva.
That's true.
And they're thinking, what?
Quote of the week.
What exactly?
Yeah, and that's how we get listeners.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Miles. Just curiosity.
Do you have something else on this, Ben?
I was just going to say, I think it's pretty interesting because right now we do this with a lot of other things. Like, for example, voice recognition. You know, you talk into your phone, it sends it off to a server. The server does the work. It sends back whatever the transcribed text is. I wonder that if as technology gets more powerful, as the chips in our little phones get faster, we might be able to do those things on the phone, as well as potentially even something like that, like analyzing really complex data to you know, figure out a diagnosis.
Like a tricorder.
Let's move on. Tricorder.
Mm. This is...
anybody know if Galaxy Zoo has a phone app?
I was talking about Galaxy Zoo with somebody. I couldn't remember the name of it. Galaxy Zoo is this really cool thing where you can look and classify galaxies by an image. You can say it's a spiral or not. You kind of help science by...
And yes, they do. For the last 6 months, they've had a mobile phone. Yeah.
Okay, hold on to that for a second. No geek bit. But Al, can you tell us about something a little less esoteric?
Less esoteric. Well, how about concrete?
Something concrete would be great.
All right, something really concrete. Okay, how about concrete?
Yes, something concrete would be fine.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Who's up first?
Can we talk about it then?
Nothing too heavy. Make it be light.
Okay. Light and concrete? Okay. Yeah. How about this?
I'm sensitive.
Okay. How about this? Light, sensitive, concrete.
You wouldn't have a story on that one.
There we go.
Perfect.
Okay, that would be too... I've satisfied everybody in the room.
Okay, now you have to make something up. Go.
Yeah. Apparently, the University of Tokyo... there has developed a light-sensitive concrete. There's a researcher, Tokiho Fukio is the name of the guy, and he's created this concrete. It looks like regular concrete, but inside it's got embedded optical fibers, photodiodes, and electrical circuitry and stuff. And the optical fibers are distributed within a regular grid within the concrete, and sensors are beneath them, kind of connected in the same way. And so it gives the concrete interactive properties, light-sensitive properties, which are then transmitted to a computer. So, but it looks like regular concrete. It still has the durability of regular concrete. So, it's really a bizarre thing to think about because, it may open up the world to say things like just put your hand on a wall or there's just like no interface. It's just like concrete,
right? So basically you're taking like a base level construction material that actually can sense where people are, mm-hmm. can interact with it, figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean,
you can see this in sidewalks, control street lights, right? You come to the intersection, it knows, oh, there's 14 people standing here, and over there there's only three, so we're gonna change lights this direction,
mm-hmm. which is
just from concrete,
which is very cool. And it's reasonably, it's not some horrible thing where you take millions of dollars to make a little brick, it's a technology that they've developed. It's kind of cool. It's from a website called Transmaterial, and they talk about all sorts of neat materials like light tape and different kinds of ways of putting graphics on concrete. And it's kind of a neat site. I'm going to put the link in the show notes, so it's worth checking out for the light sensitive concrete, and as well as all the other neat stuff that's on this website.
All right, thank you very much. In a minute, Miles is going to talk about a an unknown lizard. But first, what's going on with the LHC?
The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, also known as one of the, probably the biggest thing that mankind has ever built. It's a particle collider, and what they recently did is they stopped smashing protons together, and they decided to smash together some lead ions instead, just to see what would happen. No, I'm kidding. There's probably some, you know, some mathematicians that figured this out. But on the 7th of November, and this just blows my mind, the experiment that they did created temperatures that were hotter than the center of the sun, right? Sounds impressive. What if I said they were a million times hotter than the center of the sun?
Wow. How hot's the center of the sun?
Really, like really hot.
30 degrees.
the sun is a ball of incandescent gas.
But it's not. Okay.
It's a miasma of incandescent plasma. Yeah, that's right. I wasn't going to remember that. Yeah. I'm glad that you remember
that. The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma, giant.
Earlier we were talking about
furnace.
Theme songs. This is why Miles does not create theme songs.
Because he steals them from other artists.
Star Wars. Getting that Star Wars.
Where's the slider?
Go. Oh, thank you. That's much nicer. But yeah, so that it just kind of blows my mind. That I mean, also as I was reading this article, this is a quote from it, and I just find this really funny because it's so beyond anything that I can understand in my brain naturally. Quote: this process took place in a safe, controlled environment, generating incredibly hot and dense subatomic fireballs with temperatures over 10 trillion degrees.
Nice.
That seems like a
safe
contradiction to me. Like a safe, controlled environment, 10 trillion degrees. What? That's
awesome. Thank you, Ben, for the science update on the LHC.
Pretty intense.
Miles, can you talk about some biology for a moment?
Yes. Some folks were heading down to Vietnam, you know, just kind of, you know, out for the sights, checking out biology as biologists are wont to do.
Mm.
In this case, it might be zoologists, but much the same. And they were noticing on the menu there was this thing they didn't know exactly what it was, and it was some lizard. And then they realized after doing some research that this lizard on the menu, on a Vietnamese menu, had never been cataloged in
a new species.
Western taxonomy.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And so, yeah, a new species. It reproduces asexually, so every birth is a virgin birth.
Mm-hmm.
And
amazing.
Praise the Lord.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's like...
Why didn't people know about this lizard if people were eating it? You'd think that that's pretty
I
common.
I said Western taxonomy. That's
right.
Not say that
no, I know
they
that.
Didn't. In
know
Vietnam,
that.
It was a very common dish.
So it was so common that it just never came up as a scientific issue. So like, oh, okay, we're out in the field. Okay, look, we're hungry, let's go here, and we're chatting. Okay, yeah, this is good food.
But it never comes up. That or Western scientists were kind of looking at the menu and going, maybe not.
Okay, are these domesticated, raised animals, or are these, you know, just hunted?
I believe they're hunted. But then again, I'm sure someone has a whole batch that they just wait until they procreate.
Reproduce.
Or reproduce. They don't really, yeah.
They don't procreate, but they reproduce. All right. You remember that?
Wait, what is the lizard version of?
I don't know. Al, can you just talk about one more interface design that's
sure.
Like weird?
There was a neat thing that Nokia put together. It's called, they're labeling it stretchable electronic skin. And they've created this sort of like a stretchable, rubbery kind of, it's like a rubber band kind of thing. And you can just stretch it. But the whole thing is touch sensitive. So it responds to touch and pressure, which opens up the idea of, well, maybe you could put like some sort of band on your arm, and then you'd be able to control a computer just on this like stretchable band. This is from the Nokia Research Center, and I'm going to post a YouTube video of this thing in use, and it's pretty cool. And there's a woman that describes the whole thing. It's a, you know, kind of a neat just an electronic skin
that has more stretchy, touchy mm-hmm. qualities.
Yes.
Great. Thank you very much, Al. You're listening to KOSP, Central Coast Public Radio. We're in Santa Cruz right now. The geeks today are Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Al Luckow. My name's Lyle Troxell. Before we introduce our guest, Al, one little geek bit, if you would. Or is it Miles? You both have one, so let's both
give it to Miles.
Okay, go for it, Miles.
I got a quick rapid fire. One, Marie Curie, born November 7th. only person to ever win Nobel Prize in two different fields. I'm going to put up a link to a RC plane that goes 400 miles an hour.
Excellent. We've all watched this thing. You will,
awesome.
Like, smile.
Yes. And Galaxy Zoo has an iPhone app, a mobile app, and iPad. So
very cool. It's good for the
put
plan.
Those all up on the site.
You know, the other thing we've got to mention, well, maybe we'll mention it later in the show, but the robot that touches people is this creepy owl. We got to potentially...
I think you just covered
you
it.
Wanna,
yeah. Wait, that's all we want to say. Geekspeak.org.
Yeah, we'll do it in...
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. Our guest today, John Moon, has 29 years experience in design engineering and design management of hard disk drives. He has been with Seagate for the last 20 years. His design responsibilities have spanned all aspects of electrical design, from servo and read-write to ASICs and interface. He has been involved in Seagate's hybrid design efforts from the beginning, most recently serving as the lead design engineer for the launch of a product which we're actually going to talk a lot about today, Momentus XT. John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, thank you very much. Sounds kind of boring after talks of STDs and fireballs, but we'll try to make it exciting.
Let's first just define what a hybrid hard drive is, because it's not a Prius. We don't have gas engine in there, but can you describe what a hybrid hard drive is?
Yeah, so it really is just simply we put some NAND flash on the front end, and then you've got the rotating disks in addition to that, and part of your data is stored in the NAND flash, and part of your data is stored in the on the rotating disks. And the main reason behind that is, you know, the way I like to call it is, you know, we try to make it act like an SSD, but with this huge cheap data tank hanging on the back of it.
Right.
An SSD, solid-state drive, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about solid-state drives because they're this new and upcoming technology which allows you, I mean, it's been around for 3 or 4 years, of course, but it's basically a drive that has no moving parts, and it's extremely fast. It uses low power, and they're
potentially
awesome.
Can.
Yeah, they're awesome, but unfortunately, they're extremely expensive right now because of the amount of tech in them, and you can't get the volume, the amount of storage in them. So what you're basically doing is you're taking a traditional hard drive that spins, has platters, has really complicated parts, that the reason why hard drives fail all the time is because of these things, and you're but really cheap storage from a general megabit count.
Do you actually know the off the top of your head what the price per gigabyte is these days for hard drives versus SSDs? Just to give people a sense of scale here, like
yeah, to give you a sense, I mean, you know, I may be a little bit off, but the hard drives are typically in the pennies per gigabyte, and the solid-state drives are approaching more like the dollars per gigabyte.
Right.
Yeah, I think 6 cents a gigabyte. You can get a 2-terabyte hard drive for like $120.
Right.
Right.
So
it's a significant difference.
Right. And so, if for example, you trying to buy like a 500-gigabyte solid-state drive, they're too expensive. I mean, that's the basic issue, why people don't have them everywhere, right?
Right, right. There's no doubt the solid-state drive does do wonderful jobs as far as the speed of the data, the no rotating part, you know, it's quiet, you don't hear it and everything, but, yeah, they're just hugely expensive.
It kind of is a good analogy when you think about a hybrid car, because hybrid cars, you know, you like the idea of an electric car. They're efficient. They do all these things. But they're really not that useful in a sense, because they only go so far before they run out of, you know, so you kind of have to have the gas in there too, which this drive is kind of, it actually adds the value, because you have the flash RAM on there, the flash memory, and then you've also got this spinning traditional memory. And one thing that that I'm curious about is, when, you know, and these drives are targeted at laptops, correct?
That's correct.
So you have one of these drives, and I was a friend of mine got one of these, and he was just like, "Whoa, my machine is so fast! It's like twice as fast booting, and all these things." So, is there some sort of intelligence that when you start using the drive, it knows what data to put on where, or do you have to know what you're going to put on? Put on the flash part, and what you're going to put on the platter part.
The drive does it all by itself, and of course the marketing guys have come up with a clever name, adaptive memory. But essentially, what it does is it watches what accesses to the drive happen. You know, so as you load an application, or as you boot your drive, it looks and looks to see what sectors on the drive are being accessed, and then it decides which of those to put into the flash memory for future accesses to speed things up. And one of the ways we get by with not having to put, you know, so for the Moment SXT, we've got 4 gigabytes of flash on there. And a lot of people ask, well, you know, so 4 gigabytes of flash isn't very much. How do you, you know, am I limited on what I put in there and what benefit I can get? But what we do is we don't put, you know, so for instance, if you're loading up a file or loading up an application, we don't put everything inside the flash. What we do is we look at the things that on a typical disk drive take a long time to access. So, you know, disk drives are pretty fast if you're just taking sequential sectors off the disk. It's when you start having to skip all over the disk and seek halfway across the disk and wait for it to rotate, that's when things start to slow down. What we've found is, you know, if we study the way the OS has used the drive and everything, that a good portion of the data comes off the disk fairly fast, but then there's these little portions of data that just cost lots of time to get to. That's what we go after. So we watch for that, and we say, okay, those, we can get the benefit of just taking those straight out of flash. So we'll put those in flash. The next time you load up that program, then it goes to the flash to get that and gets the other stuff off the disk, and that's where we get the benefit.
And so let's do a little bit of real-world kind of description of this. Let's say you have a photo that's a 4-gig photo, and you've just taken it from your camera, and you're going to open that in an application like Photoshop. Right off the bat, putting that in flash would make no sense because you've got to get it. You're only going to use it once, really. You're going to open it up and edit your photo. So as you open it up, the hard drive goes to a certain location where the actual memory of that photo is stored, and it starts reading. And it reads relatively straight along the path, getting all the sectors that the data is in, and then you've got the file. So it's one travel over to the location, start reading, keep reading at the same location, and then travel again to the next spot, and you're done. But what you're talking about is when you launch the application like Photoshop, you've got to open a preference file, you've got to access libraries that allow you to control different aspects like the fonts. I mean, you're going to have a lot of resources that application has to touch and have access to and load into running memory space. And when it does all those things, it's going to go, let's say it has to do 15 things. So now it's got to go to 15 different times along the disk and find that spot and read this very small amount of data, which you don't even think about as very important. But when you stack it up, because you're doing it so many times, instead of doing that, the hard drive system you're talking about basically says, well, that was a really long process, so we'll take all that long process that has actually small amounts of data and store it in our fast read space. Next time you run Photoshop, it doesn't have to do all those access points, and it goes really fast, even though it's not going to affect the speed of loading the photo at all.
That's an excellent way of describing it. You do better than I do at describing it. That's exactly years. What it does.
So,
and if you look at it, one of the things that for instance, happens on a disk drive is what we found is the DLLs. Because, you know, you may have a drive when you first get it that is really fast, you know, because you've loaded programs and the DLLs get loaded right next to where the application is, and you're okay.
And so just a second, a DLL is a dynamic link library. This is a library that the application used. This is a Windows dynamic link library, but
right.
Go on.
And they're typically very small little files. But what happens is that a lot of the DLLs are commonly used between different applications. And so when you go load a new application on there, you know, it'll go out there and it'll look and it'll say, oh, these common DLLs are already out there, so I'm not going to load them. Well, if you keep doing that and you uninstall programs and install more programs and uninstall them, after a while, that DLL that's used for an application, you know, for a new application that's loaded can be scattered very far away from that application.
Right.
So those are a lot of the ones that end up
the dynamic link library is this idea, and I'm assuming in a Macintosh environment there's the same thing. Miles, what in a Unix-based environment is equivalent to a DLL?
A shared library.
So anything in the lib directory, basically.
Or user lib or
lots
any
of, places,
of the, yeah.
Right. Basically, these shared libraries are equivalent to, let's say we have a library that says, I know how to talk the HTTP protocol, like so HTTP protocol, and therefore don't write this again. So no applications actually know how to do that necessarily on your computer except for one little tiny bit of code that does it very well, and it gets updated with the OS most likely, and everyone uses that to access you know, web content, basically. This is a bad example, but it's good enough because it doesn't really work that way. And so what you're saying is Photoshop might use it because it might have resources online that it wants to access, and it has to load it. And 15 other applications are going to use that one little thing. And this little bit of code is probably under a meg, but if everyone is going to access the hard drive to start using it, it becomes really ridiculously time-consuming. And so these little things get stored in Flash. The thing that's interesting to me is that you're solving kind of an operating system problem with a hardware solution. I mean, because if the operating system was just better at this kind of thing, you'd think that it would handle this itself.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that, I mean, if you're familiar with the history of hybrid drives, the first ones that came out, I think it was 2007, were tied to Microsoft's Vista, and Microsoft's Vista had a feature called Ready Drive. And essentially, that would utilize a hybrid drive. I mean, we would do a drive, and on that one, the big difference is we put the flash on the drive, but essentially we turned all control over to the OS and said, okay, along the lines of what you're saying, you put the stuff inside there.
Yeah, I remember talking about this around Vista, and then you could even get a relatively small SSD type of hard drive, or even a USB hard drive if it had fast enough speed, the OS would start using two different drives, basically. It would decide. So, and Vista had that. So, yeah, so go on. What's happening?
And part of the trouble is, it's kind of this advantages on one side and advantages on the other side. So, the OS has the advantages, of knowing, especially associations between files and, in the disk drive world, what we call logical block addresses, which are the sectors in the drive. And so they know that for any particular file, I'm going to use these LBAs in the drive. And that gives them an advantage. The difficulty they have is that disk drives have gotten so complicated now, instead of the LBAs or the sectors being logically oriented on the drive from one, from the ID to the OD like they used to be, there's all sorts of things that go on inside the drive that those LBAs, the mapping of those LBAs to physical locations in the drive varies quite a bit.
So, you're leaving a lot of our audience behind there.
sorry.
Can you tell us what an LBA is?
Logical block address. So if you look at data that is stored on a disk drive, it's stored in chunks of 512 bytes, which are called a sector. And each of those sectors has an address, and that's called the logical block address. So when an OS goes to store a file, I mean, the file obviously is going to be a lot larger than 512 bytes, so they take thousands of these LBAs to store that file. And they're the ones that say, okay, I'm going to take this file and I'm going to put it in LBA 0 through 10,000. Mm-hmm. Now, the trouble is that the disk drive, the internal workings of the disk drive, is the only ones that know physically on which disk, which side of the disk, and how far, what radius that set of LBAs is located, physically located at. Location that takes the time.
And let's just describe this kind of like records, because at least some of our listenership will understand what an album is. You understand there's different tracks on an album, and let's say you've got a volume with maybe four records in it. You've got an album that actually has four albums in it, if you will. And if you have that mapping on the outside that says, oh, I want to listen to this concerto, it's on disc four, track six on that disc, finding it's actually kind of a bit of a process. What you're saying is that process of where it is actually all internal to the hard drive. Seagate might release a hard drive that has three platters or two platters, and the actual distance from the ring of the platter, if you will, the amount of time it takes to get to it because of where it is on the disc is going to vary as well, the track, if you will. So all that information is so complicated that asking the operating system to understand it and translate that to the operating system is actually a fault in the design of allowing it to address it itself.
This has actually been an issue for operating system operating system developers too. I'm assuming they've always wanted like more lower level, and is it true like the hard drive manufacturers are trying to push back, going, no, we got it.
Yeah, and that's a lot of it is because
are you still there with us?
Sorry about that. You guys still there?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Still there.
That's me tripping on something. Anyway, A lot of the issues is because to get the kind of capacities that you get on a hard drive these days, it's pretty complex. It's not nearly as simple as it was, you know, if you go 20, 25 years ago. And so that complexity, you know, if you left it up to the OS, one, you know, it varies depending on who's making your platters, who's making your heads and all that, and it would just be a nightmare for them to try to be able to handle every variation. So we take a lot of that, you know, over the years have taken a lot of that control over onto the disk drive of managing that. And this is kind of like the next step on that, in that, you know, the OS doesn't know from one drive to the next which parts of the data, you know, which of the physical blocks are the difficult ones to get to.
Right.
And so that's where we have the advantage. Yeah.
And this makes a lot of sense to me to get rid of the operating system understanding that kind of complexity, because, of course, we don't really want the hard drive to be tied to the operating system. We'd like to be able to yank the hard drive out, put a new hard drive in, and have the operating system not have a change at all, assuming the data is still the same.
Exactly. It's kind of like what they did with video cards, where they offload video mm-hmm. processes to the card itself rather than relying on the computer.
The CPU, yeah.
I'm wondering, basically, this Momentus XT has this intelligence built in. Is there a perception of two drives, or does it just seems like one drive, and you just don't even know? Like, you get this
It just seems as one drive.
Because I'm reminded of the RAM disk of the early, you know, the 90s and stuff, when we used to make these RAM disks, and you kind of had this, like, you would portion part of your RAM for, like, rapid access data, and so it was like a hard drive. How does that compare to the old RAM disk?
Yeah, so on this one, there's absolutely no interaction or no operations needed from the operator or the OS. It's completely invisible. Matter of fact, the 4 gigabytes of flash that are out there don't show up as added capacity at all. And all of the data that's in the flash is actually mirrored on the disk, too.
Oh, interesting.
And so with the Momentus XT, and that's one big thing different from Vista, you just take it, any drive, it comes with the SATA interface, and mm-hmm. so any slot that has a SATA interface, you just slide this in, and it's invisible. You don't have to do anything.
So it is multi-platform, too, because we're mentioning Vista a lot, but I know a friend of mine put it in his PowerBook.
Right, yep. That's nothing
to do with the operating system. Absolutely. And that's the other beauty. That's the thing when we changed from being tied to Vista, is one of the things we wanted to be able to do was to make it so that essentially it will work with any OS. And, you know, ideally, even on the Microsoft platform, you can retrofit it back into an XP device with an XP, and it'll work. Because it's not looking at the file tables at all. It just purely looks at which blocks are being accessed in the drive, which is standard across any OS you have out there.
This is KOSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. We also have Al Luckout, Miles Eleman, Ben Jaffe. We're talking with John Moon. John Moon is a design engineer with Seagate. We're talking about the hybrid hard drive technology, specifically the Momentus XT line of Seagate's, though other vendors are coming out with the same type of idea. And the basic concept is have a hard drive and flash memory, and the drive is intelligent enough to use the flash memory when it's needed to lessen the amount of time the hard drive spins. It's a great way to get cheap, faster hard drives. We are taking your calls with questions regarding this subject. If you'd like to ask a question we're not covering, please feel free to call. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Miles, I think you had a question for John?
Yeah, so what about those of us who have more than one operating system on a machine? Have you guys done any internal testing, like what the performance is like or what the trade-offs are?
Yeah, I mean, as far as whether you get performance boost on both operating systems?
Right, or how much that performance boost is degraded, you know, is the performance boost like a little bit more on two of them?
Miles,
or
are you talking about partitioning your hard drive and having two OS on
right,
the same hard drive?
Right, you have Ubuntu on one partition and then Windows on another.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
John?
That's an interesting question, and as I'm sitting here pondering it, you can tell we probably haven't done much testing on that. I'm pondering it.
But would the flash part of the RAM be partitioned as well, in the sense would the hard drive use half of it for one partition and half of another, or would it look at the in RAM? Is it called in RAM? What is this stuff called? The flash, the
actual NAND flash.
NAND flash. Okay, the NAND flash. Would a partitioning of the hard drive actually result in kind of half use of that?
No, actually, what it'll do, it will still, because the way we use the NAND, essentially the drive, if you look at it from the drive side, the drive doesn't really know it's partitioned. I mean, it just knows you're either accessing these LBAs or the other LBAs. It's the file system that knows the drive is partitioned. And so with that, what will happen is, depending on which OS you're using the most, that will be the one that will be that the data will be tended to put into the NAND flash. It'll use it regardless of which OS you're using.
Does the NAND flash store its data per reboot cycles, or do you wipe it and reuse it every time you start the hard drive up?
No, it stores it between cycles, and that's one of the advantages of the NAND flash is that it's non-volatile, and so we can store it between. And a lot of the people that have bought the Momentus XT, that's what their first thing they notice is that their boot times are significantly improving. Even though we haven't done much testing, we have had some people put it in a dual boot system and report that they see a benefit on both boots.
Mm-hmm. So what if you have a hard drive and you use it for maybe a year and it understands what your preferences are for which sectors of the drives, and then let's say that you decide to get another hard drive and you give this hard drive to someone else, they wipe everything, they reinstall an operating system. Is the drive intelligent enough to know that these sectors have been cleared, they aren't necessarily preferred anymore, start over?
Yes, what it does, it's constantly watching what's going on, and what it'll do is that anytime it sees a sector that it thinks is beneficial to go into the flash, no matter what it's put in there in the past, it will put it in. The only time it has to start thinking about it is if you've done enough stuff, and a lot of times this will happen, like your case where you transfer it, where you've completely filled up the flash, and it says, okay, I'm completely full, and now somebody comes around with something else, and it says, oh, I could benefit from putting that in the flash, but there's no space in the flash. Well, then it's got a algorithm that sits there and looks and says, okay, how often is this being used versus how long has it been since that other stuff was used, and which one's gaining the more time, and it readjusts itself and takes stuff out of the flash and puts stuff new in as needed. And so if a whole new operator came, it would essentially learn their patterns and switch out to them what they use.
Earlier, when I described what you do, I mentioned one of the things in your bio is ASICs. Can you tell us what an ASIC is?
Yeah, so the ASIC is a custom circuit. Stands for Application Specific Integrated Circuit. And so we custom design the integrated circuit that controls everything that's going on inside the disk drive is all done in one very large chip that we custom design.
Okay.
And there's actually, a lot of people may not know this, we actually have microprocessors inside those chips also that are pretty powerful.
Right. Okay, cool. Al, you got a question for John?
So what could a person reasonably expect to see if, you've got a drive and you said, oh, my drive is going bad or I want improvement. I get one of these Momentus XT things. I put it in my laptop. What I'm going to basically see what kind of experience. Why would I want this? Is things going to be faster? I mean, what kind of things would a person benefit from?
Okay. So the first thing you'll see is your boot times improving. Mm-hmm. And in particular, anybody who's had a drive around for a while and if they move their image from that drive and copy all their data over to the new drive and put it in, and typically we've heard back, anywhere from a 20% to a 50% faster boot time.
Wow.
My particular system at work, I had a lot of stuff on there, and it's a Windows machine, because it's at work. But anyway, it would probably take about a minute and a half to boot up. I put the image over on the Momentus XT, put it in, and now it takes about 30 seconds to boot.
Wow.
I got a pretty hefty improvement.
Yeah.
The other thing you'll see is then on a lot of applications that load, and in particular, the ones that take a long time. You'll see some applications that don't take very long. what we've seen is if you do things like with Adobe Premiere, Adobe Photoshop, you know, photo editing and everything that take a long time to load, you'll see typically a 30% to 50% improvement in load times of those.
John, I know this isn't very pleasant to ask, but we're a public radio. We want to cover the basis in neutrality as much as possible. You've got this hard drive. What are your competitors doing for this kind of hybrid technology? Who's doing what?
You know, we only kind of get part information out there. We know that Samsung was one of the early ones. When we did the hybrid drives with the VistaTi several years ago, Samsung was a big participant in that. Mm-hmm. Western Digital is one, you know, they're a company that tend to wait to see whether a market has really formed before they go out there. So our feeling on Western Digital is that they're probably kind of doing a watch and see to see how well Momentus XT is doing. You know, frankly, from our standpoint, you know, we kind of welcome the competitors coming out and doing it because, you know,
it proves the technology, right? When you've got more.
Well, yeah, it proves the technology, and we really think. I mean, one of the quotes that our CEO Steve Luzzo has made is that he thinks in 5 years, 80% of the drives will have this kind of technology on it, just because it makes sense.
Okay, but let me counter with that. Is it possible that in 5 years we won't have spinning platters anymore?
Well, you know, that's always been the threat. But with SSDs, the difficulty is, you know, and this starts getting really detailed, if you go study NAND flash, that to get the NAND flash cheaper and cheaper, which is what they use on SSDs, they're running across more and more problems. And in particular, with problems of wearing out the flash and with being able to retain the data from the flash. And so, you know, we kind of look at it and say, well, you know, the concept of an SSD is great, but, you know, you're never going to, a lot of the predictions now is that the price is never going to cross the price of a rotating disk.
We just got a lot of technology in those rotating disks. John Moon from Seagate is a design engineer. John, thank you so much for being here. We're out of time today.
Oh, quite welcome.
Thank you so much. Very, very great technology briefing. Thank you. Take care.
Glad to talk about it.
Bye-bye. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have been Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Al Luckow. Thanks, geeks, for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Most certainly.
For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.